Okay, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Ryan Walsh, the moderator of today's panel. I'm a partner at Imerstall, a law firm based in Chicago, but with offices in a few other states, including Wisconsin, where I work. It's good to be here today, and I'm looking forward to our conversation. We all have heard a fair amount about Judge Amy Coney Barrett. We know she went to Rhodes College, she went to University of Notre Dame Law School. We know that she went to a firm in DC for a while and practiced after having clerked for Judge Williams and Justice Scalia. We know also that she has spent most of her career as an academic in Notre Dame, and we know that she's a Seventh Circuit judge today. But what most of us don't know is the Amy Barrett in action, Amy Barrett, the teacher, Amy Barrett, the person, and Amy Barrett, the judge. And so today, you know, although this event is billed as the judicial philosophy of Amy Barrett, we're also going to touch on just who Amy Barrett is. And we're going to hear from three excellent panelists who have special insight on just that question. Let me introduce them now. The first is Amanda Rao Beery, who is an associate in Miller Canfield's Litigation and Dispute Resolution Group. She is a magna cum laude graduate of the University of Michigan Law School, where she was associate editor of the Michigan Law Review and co-president of the Women Law Students Association. She received her BA from Hope College in Michigan and an MDiv from Duke University. Next up is John Adams, who is a stakeholder at Imerstall and a colleague of mine at the firm Chicago and Madison offices. He focuses his practice on appellate and complex litigation in a variety of areas. He has worked as an appointed member of the Legal Services Corporation. And before joining Imerstall, he was an associate in the appellate and white collar groups of an Am Law 25 firm. He served as law clerk to the Honorable Amy Coney Barrett a few years ago. And before his legal career, John, a decorated veteran, served as an infantry officer in the United States Marine Corps. Next up is Robert Driscoll, a shareholder in Reinhardt's labor and employment practice. Rob's practice covers a wide variety of litigation related issues facing employers, and he counsels employers to help them avoid disputes before they start, with an emphasis on discrimination, wage and hour, and other issues. He also practices before the National Labor Relations Board and is a labor arbitrator. He received his Bachelor of Arts, summa cum laude, from Hillsdale College, my alma mater, yet another liberal arts college in Michigan among the crew. And he received a Master of Politics from the University of Dallas and his JD, magna cum laude, from the University of Notre Dame Law School, where he was a student of Professor Barrett. So with the introductions out of the way, let's start with Amy Coney Barrett, the person. And I want to start with Rob. So Rob, what had you heard about Professor Amy Barrett before law school? Anything? And if nothing, what was your introduction to this person? And what did you learn about her as a student? And what in particular struck you about her as a professor?
Yeah, thanks, Ryan. I didn't know anything about Professor Barrett when I joined, when I became a Notre Dame law student. My first kind of experience with her was in civil procedure, my second semester of my 1L year, where she was my professor. And then I subsequently had her for evidence in my second year and then a statutory interpretation seminar my third year. You know, so there was a development there over the 3 years, and she was still a relatively young and new professor. And what struck me the most during my 1L year was the method that she controlled the classroom. And I don't mean just, you know, rowdy behavior or anything like that, but more how she kept students' interests and taught the material. I think all of us that have gone to law school have had a variety of professors that have used a variety of, some use just pure terror of, you know, calling on people. And while Professor Barrett was funny, and while being called on her could be terrifying as well, those came about because of her poise in the classroom, her absolute command of the material that she was presenting, and the knowledge that no matter how good your answer would be to a question, she would find a way to pick a hole in it, even if she ultimately agreed with what you were saying. And I think that's how I kind of experienced her first, and then, you know, subsequent classes, you know, the relationship developed, you know, as students got older, more mature, better, more comfortable with the material. I think that her classroom style opened up from there as well, and became almost more collaborative rather than more of a lecturer or a lecturing style.
So Robin, those big lecture classes, when she shows up on the first day, is it intimidating? Is she a hardcore Socratic type professor?
I have a sense of it being intimidating. That being said, it was my second semester, so you know, you're a little experienced, you have a few under your belt already. But she, it's not that, you know, she was terrifying as a person. She's a very nice person. It's more just the knowledge that no matter how well you prepare, you could prepare more, right? And that she's always going to know it better than you. And so again, it wasn't someone who was terrifying because they're mean or rude or whatever the case, wanted to embarrass you. It was just the knowledge that, you know, she was prepared and had that poise at the head of the classroom and wasn't going to get flustered, or, you know, be at a loss for words to respond to whatever you said.
What classes does she teach, Rob?
I was there again, you know, I'm not sure what they were before or even while she was a judge, but I mean, I think her primary class that I really most remember was the statutory interpretation seminar, and that was a smaller class. It was maybe 10 or 12 of us. All of us had known each other pretty well, and she was really more of a facilitator there, where she was facilitating discussion amongst different styles of statutory interpretation and argument and debate amongst students, and she would prod the discussion along. And I know kind of famously now at her nomination, she mentioned she's a textual perspective that she only had in that seminar. She could push people on textualist ground just as on any other kinds of grounds, including statutory or dynamic statutory interpretation or others.
So one more question about that, Rob. You know, some professors in law school, you get the sense that they're there to teach and do scholarship on the side, or they're there to do scholarship and sort of tolerate the teaching on the side. Do you know where she falls in that continuum? Did you get a sense as a student?
My sense is that she loved to teach and she put a lot of effort into it. And it's not only that. I mean, we talk about, you know, knowing Amy Barrett as the person, right? And I only know a very small slice. But outside of the classroom was as important, if not more important, than inside the classroom, quite frankly. And, you know, I think if you've done any reading about, you know, editorials since her nomination by former students, you're going to catch these anecdotes, times where she's gone completely out of her way to help students with problems, personal problems, whatever the case may be, whatever they came to her for. And I certainly had that experience as well. And so, while, yeah, certainly a scholarship was important to her, and you can look at many law review articles she wrote, and teaching was very important to her. You know, part of teaching, I think, was part of that mentorship that happened, you know, in office hours, you know, when someone was struggling with something that she could then help and offer advice with and kind of go the extra mile for.
So, Amanda, Rob has had one kind of experience with Amy Coney Barrett, the experience of a student in the classroom, in the seminar room, in the office for office hours. But you and John had, you know, a different experience altogether, a rather unique experience in our profession, which is 1 year spent as a right-hand person to a judge, helping the judge figure out hard issues, helping, you know, her in the case of Judge Barrett, who's a new judge relatively, helping her figure out how to set up chambers, how to run things, how to establish the right relationship between and among the chambers and even in her own chambers. Before we get into, you know, how exactly she ran chambers, which we'll touch on soon, I'd like to know just about her personality as you observed it in your 1 year with her. You know, what drives Judge Barrett? What did you see in your year in close quarters with her, just as kind of a human being?
Yeah, you know, Ryan, I'm hoping that at some point I will have the words to describe her with and to do her justice. For now, I'll just do my best. Judge Barrett, she has this incredible warmth, this really compelling sense of generosity and compassion. So I began my clerkship with her 2 weeks after graduating law school. I didn't really know her well before. And so I came into the clerkship feeling very intimidated. Wasn't sure if I was going to be out of my depth, did not know what to expect. And it turns out that Judge Barrett she has just as formidable of an intellect, and she is has the same kind of incredible character that I expected. But she met us with this, she welcomed us into chambers, and it felt like a very supportive environment. It felt like a very warm environment from the beginning. I think one thing that I notice about Judge Barrett is she's an incredible listener, which of course is a very important trait for a judge, but also just an important trait as a person. And she has a very unique talent to listen well. I can't recall a single time that she ever interrupted me, which, you know, as a judge, it's usually the other way around. You don't interrupt the judges. And that, you know, that was one small way in which she showed just how seriously she took us, not just as our law clerks, but as people. You know, I think one thing that, you know, from the headlines doesn't always come through about Judge Barrett as well, is that she really has she's a subtle, but very, just really great sense of humor. And she's just good humored in general. John and I clerked for her in her very first year on the bench. So there were things, you know, things were coming at her fast, on top of all of the other responsibilities that she had outside of her new role as a judge. And she just never abandoned this very calm patience, this sense of warmth. She always had time for us to talk about cases, but also just to hear what was going on in our lives. And that always just struck me, her just incredible incredible ability to take on so much, but to do it with this sense of openness and gratitude.
So John, you know, as a litigator, you know that the word academic is usually a pejorative. You say somebody's argument is academic, or the court's opinion is too academic. What was it like for the judge coming out of academia, where she spent the bulk of her career with a very short time as a practitioner many years ago? What was it like, you know, seeing her get up to speed on the kinds of issues that federal courts of appeals wrestle with all the time? Obviously, she's got methodology down cold. She probably has evidence down cold if she was teaching that, as Rob said, fed courts, that kind of thing. But, you know, habeas, immigration, Social Security appeals. What did you get the sense that she felt like she had to bone up on that material to do her job well?
I did. And Ryan, if I could just quickly begin by expressing what a great opportunity this is to be with all of you. And as it turns out, the panelists here track my time with Judge Barrett quite neatly. Rob, if you will recall, I first met you during my first month with Judge Barrett. We were introduced and you forwarded me an invite to invite Judge Barrett to an event that you were having in Wisconsin. And when I broached the subject to Judge Barrett, her face lit up when I said, Rob Driscoll, I would like to invite you. And she said, Rob, he was one of my favorite students and will always be. And that was really special. And that happened during the first month of my clerkship. And then Ryan, of course, right after I left my clerkship, I watched you argue a case in front of Judge Barrett that you ultimately prevailed on. And so those two experiences bookend my direct interaction with Judge Barrett. And then my good friend and co-clerk Amanda is writing the epilogue right now as we see these confirmation hearings through. So it's quite something. Ryan, to return back to your question, Judge Barrett, of course, has expertise and significant scholarship in core academic areas that we would expect appellate judges to know: constitutional law, evidence, federal rules of civil procedure, federal jurisdiction, federal rules of appellate procedure, administrative law. And so she had all those core concepts down. It was just unbelievable to watch her be able to recall significant cases, significant issues, that would be presented to her all the time. For my part, and perhaps Amanda's part too, we were just trying to keep up. The parties would bring their briefs to the court and judge would read all of them. And then she would often identify wrinkles and nuances in the law that we hadn't even thought of, or the parties hadn't even thought of, even though they have an obligation to do so, such as federal jurisdiction. And in one particular instance, I recall Judge Barrett confronting an issue that she hadn't thought about for quite some time, and that was patent law. And it was a masterclass to see her consume treatises on patent law, to consume the appellant and the appellee's briefing on the issues, and to review the cases, the precedent, and the legal issues, and then to digest all that information all before oral argument, and then to engage quite prolifically with two leading appellate attorneys from Am Law 20 firms, and to do that all before oral argument, where perhaps an easier way for someone preparing for oral argument would be to just sit there and listen to the arguments. But that's not who Judge Barrett is. She's consistently prepared and absolutely engaged with all the arguments, approaching each case with an open mind. So it was something that I really appreciated to view firsthand.
So moving to the jurisprudence of Amy Coney Barrett, I think we have to begin with the body of work of Professor Amy Coney Barrett. You know, she was a scholar. She is a scholar. And Rob, you know, it's a lot of material to read. I'm sure you haven't read all the law review articles yet, although we probably all will by some point. But you probably got a sense of what her academic specialties were, and you probably got a sense of what her approach to the craft of being a legal academic was. What can you say about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it bears out just looking at the titles of her law review articles, but statutory interpretation, originalism, stare decisis are some of the key areas that she was focused on throughout her tenure at Notre Dame, leading up right until she was confirmed. I think there was an article about stare decisis and originalism, maybe published in 2017. So right there. And I think that was the focus of her interest. And I think that's what probably spurred her to have the statutory interpretation seminar that I mentioned earlier. And, you know, I think in that seminar, you really did see the approach that she took. It was, you know, kind of holistic. She presented a lot of material on a lot of different viewpoints and discussed it. Didn't lecture on it necessarily, but discussed it and explained it. And then had the students really go through and discuss it amongst themselves as well. And so it was more of a helping of anything, but it was a very careful reading of things and very careful pushbacks on, you know, even on the work that you would have returned, there'd be comments on it, right? And very detailed. She was clear that she had read everything and had, you know, digested what you thought and would push back where it needed to be pushed back, or, you know, guide you in a direction, not necessarily in the right direction as it were, but in where your own thought was taking you. And she was there already, and when she was trying to bring you along to that point as well. And so I think that's how that's how her judicial approach would be as well, and it is as well, as a very careful reading of the law and a very detail-oriented and particular view of statutes and case law and the precedent.
So, John, Rob says she wrote a lot on textualism. We all know that she's pro-textualism, but we also know it's a word that's thrown around pretty liberally these days. You know, Elena Kagan famously said, "We're all textualists now," which only if that were true. I wish that were so. So what do we mean by textualism? What do we mean by originalism as Judge Barrett understands them and as she practices those methodologies?
I can start off by defining them and then going into the value of originalism and textualism. Originalism, as Judge Barrett has stated, she's an originalist, and as she has defined it, originalism views the law as fixed at the time it was ratified. That could be, for example, a constitutional amendment, and the ordinary meaning of the law controls if it's discernible. And textualism, similarly, is guided by the words of the statute, and in certain circumstances, the Constitution, instead of vague and unknown notions of purpose or intent, which are almost impossible to discern. And the values of originalism and textualism are really grounded in things that I think we as practitioners or anybody in the law can appreciate: stability, consistency, predictability, as well as people who rely on precedent or what is stated in the law, the ordinary meaning of the words, as they orchestrate and organize their lives around what the law means. And for those types of principles, it's important for an originalist and a textualist to adhere to, because it prevents judges from instilling any type of personal views or public policy preferences, or even caving to public pressure to rule in a certain way because they are constrained by the words on the statute or the words in the Constitution. And there's also an element of legitimacy to adhering to the law as it is written and ratified by those who can pass law, the legislatures, or in the case of the Constitution, we the people. Instead of judges updating statutes or legislating from the bench, they interpret the law faithfully. And those are the types of principles that we can expect from a Justice Barrett.
So textualists are famously against legislative history. The idea is that legislative history is never voted on and signed by the president. And furthermore, lobbyists and staffers can put anything they want in the legislative history. So you can use it to color your interpretation one way or the other. As Scalia clerks, you are taught not even to read the legislative history in the briefs. There are footnotes and briefs that I worked on as a Supreme Court clerk that I have never read because they contain legislative history. Do you think Judge Barrett might follow a similar rule in her chambers?
I think that's true. She, of course, also clerked for Justice Scalia and learned the same lessons that you did. But as a statutory interpretation expert, Judge Barrett would always start with the text, and then if there is an ambiguity in the text, employ canons of construction that can help inform the judge on what the legislatures meant when they passed the statute. And there are also other ways to identify what could be intended by the legislatures if you have to move beyond the words of the text, such as the purpose of the statute or even the structure of the statute. And legislative history would be very low on that list, if ever considered.
I once remember saying to Justice Scalia, "We start with the text." And he screamed at me, "We don't start with the text, we end with the text." So, but on that question, let's see if that's really how, you know, a textualist should approach his or her art, or an originalist. Amanda, let's talk about precedent. She's written on stare decisis. You know, many of us are aware that originalists have a wide variety of views on stare decisis. The two extremes are basically, one, never follow it because you're bound by the text of the law, and you're bound in the case of originalism by the Constitution. That's what you take an oath to uphold. That's the supreme law. So always apply the Constitution. Precedent is almost irrelevant. It's like a brief filed in the case. And then on the other side, people say, well, you know, precedent is part of the law developed by the Article III judiciary. And so it's basically like either constitutional common law, or it's somehow part of the body of law that judges must confront. So it is part of the law, and you should, you know, pay it the ordinary respect it's due. I mean, I know none of us really knows where exactly Amy Coney Barrett falls on that as a judge, because she's never been a Supreme Court justice, and so she's never had the opportunity to apply these principles. But how would you characterize her general perspective on stare decisis, both as applied to statutes and the Constitution?
Yeah, I mean, Rob kicked us off helpfully here. And as you say, she's written a lot of very interesting scholarship in this area, which I would encourage you all to go check out if you're interested in this. Precedent is obviously plays a foundational role in our legal system. And it's something that Judge Barrett has said, you know, in her scholarship, that she considers stable precedent to be a very important part of our system. And, you know, we saw, John and I as clerks saw her put that into action as a Court of Appeals judge, where she was both applying, you know, vertical precedent from the Supreme Court and horizontal precedent, which is, you know, the previous decisions of the Seventh Circuit. And in that role, we really saw Judge Barrett read cases very carefully and read them closely. And it was, you know, in the area of applying precedent, it was one of the ways that we got to see her incredible legal mind at work. You know, we always talk about just applying precedent as if it's this just like easy kind of straightforward thing, but cases and the law, or that it's just something that you do or you don't do or whatever, do require that close understanding to know, you know, when is a case applicable, when is it distinguishable. And Judge Barrett did that very carefully. I think one area in her cases where you see that, where she's following Supreme Court precedent, is in her habeas dissents, you know, where she's reading AEDPA, the statute that governs the review of those cases, very carefully, and then having to carefully parse Supreme Court precedent as she's making those decisions. So I think that's kind of her, you know, Judge Barrett on the Court of Appeals applying precedent in action. And then I think if you look to her scholarship, she's written quite a bit about precedent, about stare decisis. And she stated, you know, that precedent does play a very important role in our system. It helps maintain predictability, stability. She's called it a sensible rule. And I think to this end, she's talked a lot about Justice Scalia's quote unquote pragmatic approach to precedent and pragmatic originalism, and that, you know, carves out a role for precedent in certain circumstances. And she said, I think also following along with Justice Scalia, that being an originalist doesn't require a judge to go rooting around for looking for precedent to upend. She writes in one of her articles that it would be foolhardy for a judge to go looking for trouble. So I think that precedent does and likely will continue to play an important role in how Judge Barrett thinks about the law.
John, anything to add to that?
It was a great summary of Judge Barrett's extensive scholarship on precedent and stare decisis. And I would continue to emphasize that she has written eloquently on the reliance interests, the stability, the consistency, and the predictability that adhering to precedent allows our society to function after. And those are very important considerations for her and for any originalist, quite frankly.
Right. I would think also that, you know, as a more conservative jurist, you know, conservatives generally are characterized by respect for what has come before and humility. So I would think, you know, any good judge, and especially a judge who thinks, you know, people might have had things figured out a long time ago, would want to know how judges have come out on the question before. And you'd read it with great interest, like you'd read a brief with great interest. But of course, there's all the more reason to, because of the doctrine of stare decisis.
I think that's right. And I think I would say the same thing for textualists and originalists too. There are certainly elements of humility and modesty that the judge cannot possibly know all of the considerations that went into before. And you have to take a step back at certain times and be humble when you confront an issue of precedent or text in a statute.
Right. Let's talk about Judge Barrett at the Seventh Circuit. And Amanda, let me start with you. How did she approach cases? How did she have her law clerks prepare? How did she want you to help prepare her? Were there in-person discussions, memos? Mm-hmm. Did she welcome counter-argument, which, you know, Justice Scalia would famously do? He would basically start fights with his door closed, and you never knew what Justice Scalia was showing up to chambers. Sometimes he would just take the other side for fun, and you would be shocked. But that's kind of how he figured out where he needed to land on a case. So what did you see?
Yeah, well, you know, we prepared for each case diligently, you know, big or small case. And that always began with the clerk who was assigned to the particular case, reading the briefs from the parties, doing the research, and preparing what we call a bench memo, which is basically an analysis of the briefs, of the legal arguments, and usually makes a recommendation, you know, what the clerk thinks about the case. Judge Barrett is at the same time doing her own preparation, and she is unbelievably thorough.
That must be amazing. Terrifying as a law clerk, by the way. The judge is writing a bench memo while you're writing a bench memo.
Well, I don't know, but you know, she's doing the same preparation, you know, she's reading cases and she's doing a lot of the prep work. And, you know, I'll throw myself under the bus here a little bit. It was not uncommon for you to, you know, read the briefs, look up all the cases, do all of your own research, feel like you've really got, you know, full handle on the world of the law with the issues in the case. And the first thing out of Judge Barrett's mouth would be something like, you know, I really think that, you know, X case is going to be like, be very significant for this issue. And I would say, I don't know X case, Judge. I have to go back and look at that. But that's, I mean, that's just her mind just a mile a minute. So it was really a spectacular thing to see. But, you know, once we kind of got, you know, the issues on the table, she did welcome disagreement and differing viewpoints. And we would sometimes, if it were a particularly big issue, Judge Barrett and all four of us clerks would talk through an issue. Often, you know, you'd be working away at your desk and I would look up and you'd see Judge Barrett in the doorway, ready to come talk through an issue. And she was always open, always available to talk through questions that we had about a case, or if we happened to see a legal issue a little bit differently. She welcomed that kind of discussion. Like you said, Ryan, I think she, you know, takes that from Justice Scalia. I think the tone and the tenor of the disagreement may be a little less intense, but no less serious. And it was an incredible learning experience. I think, you know, she said the same thing about her clerkship with Justice Scalia, that it was all downhill after that. And I know that Judge Barrett's clerks feel similarly about our experience with her. And a lot of that.
Well, except John doesn't think that.
Oh, of course not. Yeah. Yes. John has said that his current employment is his absolute dream job.
That's what I've heard.
and it's in those discussions and in those disagreements where, you know, we learned from the sharpness of her legal analysis. And that's something that, I will, you know, try to emulate for the rest of my career, and that I've carried forward.
Talk about her approach to oral argument. I mean, she talks through these cases with you all so that she can figure out the answer. She does ask questions at oral argument. I've had questions asked of me by Judge Barrett, so I know she does that. But, you know, judges have different motives, different objectives when approaching oral argument. Did you get a sense of how she thought of oral argument? You know, did she think judges should be particularly active? Did she think, you know, it was an opportunity to sort of talk to her colleagues by asking rhetorical type questions or questions that might lead the discussion one way or another?
I can take this one, Amanda. And Ryan, I'm going to flip the script on you and ask how you felt when you argued in front of Judge Barrett. I've never argued a case before Judge Barrett, but I will put out one consideration that I learned from her as she approached oral argument. Now, you mentioned earlier the patent example, and that type of diligence is something that she did every single oral argument. She was wholly prepared. She knew the record back and forth. She knew the legal arguments and she knew the facts. And she did that even for subject matters that she has expertise in, constitutional law, federal jurisdiction, or federal rules of civil procedure. But she would approach the same case in every way with diligent preparation. And then the one thing I learned from her was she told us that she would always put her shoes in the losing party or the party that she was ruling against. And she would ask herself, how would my questions at oral argument, how would my written word and the opinion be perceived by the person who I was ruling against? Would they consider it fair and just? And I could say without hesitation that it was always a consideration and that she never failed on that, with treating everybody with respect and always following where the law required. But Ryan, I'd love to hear about your experience arguing in front of Judge Barrett. And just to add a little context, Judge Barrett had dissented from a panel decision in the habeas corpus case. And then Ryan took it, petitioned in bank. The court granted it in bank, and then Ryan argued it in bank and ultimately prevailed. So I'd love to hear about what your perception was like as a litigant before Judge Barrett.
Yeah, so we saw, of course, when the three-judge panel issued their splintered opinions on whether the petitioner was entitled to habeas relief, and we noticed that Judge Barrett dissented. We also noticed that it was Judge Barrett's first dissent ever, and that it would probably get some attention. So we thought that probably bodes well for us in terms of our chances of getting en banc review. So our office, the Solicitor General's office for the state of Wisconsin, prepared a petition. Probably some folks on the call helped with it. And filed the petition. It was granted. And as John mentions, I did argue it. Now, arguing a habeas case in front of the en banc Seventh Circuit is one of the scariest things that one can do as an advocate, especially when Chief Judge Wood, my former professor, is on the other side of the question. And as I recall, she didn't write the opinion for the court, but she was very active in panel argument, and you could tell she was ready to fight. And I don't think I even got an opening statement in, and she started hammering me about how could the state of Wisconsin done this and that and the other thing. And it was a harrowing experience. Judge Barrett, what was notable about her during that argument was that she didn't seem defensive at all about her perspective on the case, which clearly got the court to take the case en banc. So she didn't think she needed to stand up for her view and throw me softballs to get Chief Judge Wood off my back. She just kind of let it play and was very respectful to both sides. I think she asked a hard question of me. I think she asked a hard question and maybe even an easy question of the other side. To your point, John, she was very solicitous of where the other side is coming from. And I really like hearing that she wrote her opinions for the other side, because I've always thought that's the model of judicial writing. But yeah, I was struck that she was quite fair and not at all gotcha, not at all interested in, you know, making news or grabbing headlines or generating buzz about her style. So that's, I think it's exactly the kind of judge that every appellate litigator wants, frankly. One who's just interested in getting the right answer and asks questions where appropriate to help her get there. And we'll talk about another case in a little bit that I didn't argue, but I was on the brief. And I noticed the same thing when one of my colleagues argued it. But before we go there, John, what was her approach to panel conferences? So typically in courts of appeal, and you'll tell me if it's different in the Seventh Circuit, there's argument and then there's a conference shortly thereafter, maybe the Friday of that week, where the three judges talk over the cases and vote and sort of divvy up assignments. Did she approach that in a particular way? Did she expect to get into a deep conversation with her colleagues? Was she looking to persuade them one way or another, or was it more of a kind of a formulaic affair where folks just voted and then just moved on?
In the Seventh Circuit, much like other places, I imagine clerks were not allowed in those conferences. It was only the judges. So I can't speak to the particulars, but what I can say is that Judge Barrett has always valued the many things that she's valued from Justice Scalia. She's always valued his relationship with Justice Ginsburg. She spoke very movingly on the relationship between Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg during her acceptance speech of the nomination, I think last week, Saturday. And that's always been a principle that's motivated her. Whatever professional differences that she may have or different views of the law that she may have from her colleagues, she would never take any of those professional differences personally. And she approaches every relationship that I have seen the same way, with respect and dignity towards the other person. And that's everything that I've seen with her interaction with her colleagues, even when there was a disagreement, such as the Schmidt v. Foster case that we just discussed, where she dissented from a panel opinion, and then that dissent was taken in bank. But all the same, she never lost any type of professional relationship or personal relationship with any of her colleagues, because that's who she is.
And we should note, John, the en banc opinion adopted her view and the vote wasn't particularly close. So she had no reason to be worried during argument that things would not go her way, it seems. Amanda, tell us about Judge Barrett's approach to drafting. So, you know, you have opinions for the court, obviously, and John's already mentioned she's writing those partly or maybe wholly for the other side. But, you know, she's also writing for the bar. I assume she has other audiences in mind as well. And then separate opinions are a totally different animal. Tell us about her approach to writing. What did she think? What did she think was the purpose of a majority opinion or a separate opinion? What was her guidance to you if you're writing the first draft? And then, you know, how many drafts did you go through? And did she sometimes just throw it in the garbage and write her own, which, you know, that happens to everybody. But, you know, or was she sort of checked out and just kind of let the clerks run the show?
Well, it will come as no surprise that a judge of Judge Barrett's caliber and dedication takes opinion writing incredibly seriously. She took every opinion we worked on, you know, every word, every punctuation mark, everything in the opinion was carefully crafted by Judge Barrett. And yeah, so first a little bit, you know, just about the process. All four of us in chambers, you know, there's the clerk who's primarily responsible for any particular case, but all four of us would be involved in the process of writing and editing and reviewing and finalizing an opinion. And then obviously, of course, the judge was the most involved. She's a very clear writer. She has a very, very unique, you know, she has a very particular writing style. She's plain spoken and she's precise. And it's important that is what comes through in each opinion. So yeah, it depended on the issue, but it wasn't uncommon for drafts to go through quite a few versions and just be refining, you know, often spending a long time on just a particular paragraph, trying to make sure that the law was faithfully applied, making sure that it was clear. And that's opinion writing and opinion drafting is really important. It's one of the biggest things that goes on in chambers. And I think, you know, there are, you know, two main reasons among others that come to mind about why it's so important to be that deliberate and careful and why Judge Barrett is that deliberate and careful with opinion writing. And the first goes back a little bit to what John was saying about the litigants. You know, every case, you know, involves parties and organizations and people who have something at stake, who have real consequences as a result of the decision, especially the party that loses. So it's important to Judge Barrett that decision be clear, and that especially the losing party again will be able to understand the law and understand why the decision came out the way it did. And then the second, you know, to recapitulate on a theme I was talking about earlier, is the importance of the decision extending beyond the case, you know, the precedential effect of the decision. And to that end, like, precise and deliberate language is crucial to avoid unintended consequences and to make sure that, you know, it's the case in front of the court that's being decided, and that the court is saying exactly what the court means in that particular case. So those are all very important factors and something that Judge Barrett and we within chambers were very cognizant of as we helped her craft the opinions.
That's helpful. So here's another question related to that. Judges, appellate judges, have totally, you know, varying views on when it's appropriate to write separately. And I think there are some judges out there who just view separate writings as entirely pointless. So if you're the losing vote, you want to affirm and your two colleagues want to reverse, mm-hmm. you might as well just join their opinion because a dissent doesn't do anything. So there are judges like that, pretty old school. They don't write separately ever. Mm-hmm. And then there are judges who write separately all the time. And, you know, I clerked for a judge on the Ninth Circuit, Judge O'Scanlan, who wrote mm-hmm. separately a lot. And I think he thought of separate writings as just, you know, his place to say if he had an important disagreement with the majority. So if it was a concurrence or a concurrence in the judgment, it was, yes, I reached the same result, but I think people need to know that I come at it from a different perspective. And if it's a dissent, you know, if you think the majority is getting it wrong, then even if you're really, really busy and your clerks are all underwater with other drafts, it's still important to dissent. And there was no exception to that. What did you observe of Judge Barrett's, you know, orientation on this question? Was she was she inclined to write separately, like some judges are that can't wait to have their own opinion out there? Or was she inclined to just kind of go along, get along?
Well, Judge Barrett does have some very important dissents and separate opinions out there. I think we're going to talk about one in a minute. And so, you know, that is something that writing separately is something that she's demonstrated a willingness to do. And I mean, I think for Judge Barrett, at the end of the day, the most important thing to her is fidelity to the law. And it's applying the law as written. It's doing what the law requires. And so I think that is kind of, I kind of see that as the core of her approach to writing separately, right? If the majority opinion is, in her view, not applying the law correctly, it's possibly something that she's going to decide to dissent on. And I think, you know, true to her character and in other areas of life, I don't see Judge Barrett's decision to write separately as a, you know, I want to get my voice out there. I think it always comes back to the law, and it always comes back to, you know, she's a true jurist. And that, at the end of the day, is the most important part of the decision. I would, at least as I, how I observed her, in her judicial decision making.
So let's talk about a couple of concrete examples of Judge Barrett's decision making. The first is Cantor, a case that's gotten a lot of attention because it's a big Second Amendment case. And Rob and I have some direct experience with it. Rob's firm represented Mr. Cantor. And although Rob didn't work on it, I'm sure he kind of looked over the shoulder of the folks who did. And my team, when I worked for the state of Wisconsin, was on the government side. It was actually Cantor versus US and Cantor versus Brad Schimmel, my boss, the Attorney General of Wisconsin. And the question was, if you're convicted of a felony, can you be not allowed to have a weapon, have a firearm for life, basically? And our argument was, you know, history shows that the framers and the founding generation understood that there's certain rights that are conditional upon good good citizenship and good character. And we thought, you know, although Mr. Cantor hadn't committed a violent crime, so the question was, you know, is it, can you have guns taken away even if the crime you committed wasn't violent? Our argument was, you know, he's still a pretty bad dude. He defrauded Medicare of hundreds of thousands of dollars. He'd done other things as well. So we thought, you know, there's a pretty good argument based on history that Mr. Cantor should not be able to carry a firearm in public. Rob, your team took a different view.
Yeah, and I'll note for the record that Attorney Walsh buried the lead a little bit here, and he forgot to mention initially that Mr. Cantor was a nonviolent felon, which was really the issue in play in the entire case. I know he wants to get past that part of the argument, but you know, I want to put that front and center. But yeah, I think that's right. And what I was most struck with from Judge Barrett's dissent in that case, when she was on the side of Mr. Cantor in our argument, and I think she got it completely correct, is the method that she went through to reach the decision that she did, that nonviolent felons had still retained a constitutional right to keep and bear arms under the Second Amendment. And, you know, the is she talks about the Heller case, the Supreme Court case, that kind of sets the boundaries of what she, as a Seventh Circuit judge, would decide. So she talks about Heller and what it resolves and what it doesn't resolve. And her decision has to be within the context of that precedent from the higher court, from the superior court. And it's only then, once that, those parameters are set, that she gets into a discussion about the history of the Second Amendment and what the founders, what the, you know, the founding convention, or the people that passed the Bill of Rights meant when they wrote the Second Amendment, who was included and who was not. And I think she goes through in that context and obliterates some of the arguments from the state as to why nonviolent felons can still be excluded from that, before then coming back ultimately to the Seventh Circuit and Seventh Circuit precedent. And so it's a very careful analysis of that takes into account her role as an inferior court judge, takes seriously the history and language of the Constitution and the Second Amendment in particular, and then also takes seriously the boundaries set by the Seventh Circuit precedent before she gets to her decision. And it's a very carefully written opinion that goes into some level of detail about fairly obscure sources that isn't always available, or the judges don't always have the time for it when they're on with a full docket. So that's kind of my impression of that case. And as I understand it, maybe don't quote me on this, but I think she listed it as one of her top cases in her Senate Judiciary Committee questionnaire, maybe even like the number one case. So it was obviously an important one for her as well, and I think an important one for anyone that's interested in that area of the law.
John, a colleague mentioned to me the other day that her favorite argument that we made in that case was that at the time of the founding, if you committed a felony, the state could and often would execute you. So a fortiori, if the state can take your life, it can at least take your Second Amendment rights. I thought that was pretty good. But what do you take away from her separate opinion in that case? What does it show about Amy Coney Barrett, the originalist, and her willingness to roll up her sleeves and try to figure out what the right answer is? You know, a lot of people criticize judges who do that. They call it law office history. Judges do their own research and try to figure out what the original meaning of an old provision is. And according to some historians, they can't do it right. Only professionally trained historians can do it. What did you see about her fidelity to her approach and just how careful or not she was when she looked into these questions?
Sure. And I don't understand the criticism of a judge rolling up her sleeves and following the law and trying to understand every nuance to the historical significance of a constitutional right to arriving to the right result. And in the case of the Second Amendment, as Rob noted, Heller is clear that the scope of the Second Amendment right is to be determined by the history of the Second Amendment right. And it seems odd to me that a state classification could automatically deprive someone of a constitutional right without any type of significant analysis. And it's a nice example of what we could expect of a Justice Barrett, for someone to take the time and take a very careful analysis of whatever case is before her to make sure that she arrives to the right conclusion. And that's what we saw in Cantor v. Barr. It's a significant dissent. It's almost 40 pages and it reads like a law review article. And Ryan and Rob, I'm not sure if you cited all the materials that she cites, but I know that she had carted in many scholarly books and scholarly law review articles to make sure that she was identifying the exact contours of the constitutional right before rendering her ultimate result. And that's something that we can expect her to do at the Supreme Court as well.
If I could just jump in there with a question that John made, and you asked about the history of it. I mean, that was a big difference between Judge Barrett's approach and the majority's approach. They kind of discuss the history of the Second Amendment just a little bit, but then they ultimately kind of just throw up their hands and say, well, it's kind of ambiguous, so we'll apply intermediate scrutiny and find it and uphold it. Whereas she, took the time to go through those arguments and all the arguments that, the state and the U.S. government had raised and talk about them in a detailed manner. And so you could see the very difference, I think that difference in approach is very consistent with, who I knew as a professor, and it's who Amanda and John have described kind of behind the scenes in her chambers and her attention to detail.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Rob. I think
Some people, when describing the doctrine of precedent or stare decisis, they actually apply a hyper-aggressive form of what it is and what it always has been. So, for example, Judge Easterbrook has famously written that Supreme Court opinions aren't statutes, so they shouldn't be read as statutes, giving effect to every word like it's some kind of code that you're bound, you know, you're bound by every dictum and all dicta in Supreme Court opinions. So what I had noticed going into that case is that basically ever since Heller was decided, all these decisions interpreting the Second Amendment individual right hung on particular phrases or footnotes in the Heller opinion. So Heller was being treated as a kind of super statute, and folks were parsing it and saying, well, it looks like they didn't mean to throw into question laws taking guns away from felons and this and that and the other thing. And there was really no attempt to apply the methodology that Heller adopts. For the most part, there are exceptions. There's a Judge Sykes, you know, exception. Maybe you worked on that one, Rob, I don't know. But, you know, I think some people, you know, when they say stare decisis, they mean just apply the words of the Supreme Court unthinkingly, when really what it means is you're bound by the holdings and the principles that drive a decision and the reasoning of a decision. And sometimes that means it's hard work because, you know, Heller didn't consider this question. So you have to apply Heller to come out with what the answer would be if the Supreme Court decided the question applying Heller. And we have a question about stare decisis, by the way. Someone's asking, you know, what are the factors that a Justice Barrett or a Judge Barrett or Amy Barrett, the professor, thinks ought to be applied when considering, you know, a question of whether a precedent governs? You know, we hear about reliance interests, you know, whether it's a statute or a constitutional provision. We hear about, you know, how erroneous is the precedent. Is there any sense, John and Amanda, of, you know, kind of what Judge Barrett's list of considerations would be?
Ryan, I think you've identified them: the reliance interest, the change in circumstance, change in society, change in law, change in facts, and commitment to predictability and consistency in the law. And as we stated earlier, there is an element of humility and modesty, and Judge Barrett is a very humble person. And if the question of confronting precedent were to be presented to her, as it may, if she's a Supreme Court justice, all those considerations would be on the table.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. Well, we're just about out of time. Any concluding remarks from our panelists before we wrap this up?
I'll just echo something that Amanda said, actually, to start her her opening remarks, which, you know, just how warmth of a personality that Professor Barrett had. I think that comes out in how she approaches the law as well. Doesn't mean you're always going to agree with her decisions, but it's certainly not anything that's, you know, derived by an agenda or an ideological, rigid ideological position. You know, there's certainly very much of a compassion there on a personal level and a professional level. And, you know, I think that's important for people to keep in mind, that even when they may disagree with the position she's taking, it's not coming from, you know, driving a particular agenda against a certain person or against a certain position. It's her, you know, view of the law that's driving it.
Great. Well, thank you, Rob. Thank you, Amanda. Thank you, John. And thank you to the Federalist Society for organizing this great panel. And I, for one, look forward to a Justice Barrett ruling for many years in the Supreme Court. So thanks to everybody. Thanks to all the attendees for coming, and have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you.